This is Julie Matthews. You are listening to Nourishing Hope on Autism One Radio. And we are back with Kara Fitzgerald, who is a naturopathic doctor at Metametrics Clinical Laboratory. And we are currently on the third show in a series that we're doing on laboratory testing and autism and clinical observations and how to use a laboratory testing to assist in the approach and the direction in working with these children on the autistic spectrum. So I want to welcome you here first, Kara. How are you?
I'm doing well, thanks. And yourself?
Great, great. So I wanted to jump into it because, boy, these have been so packed with information and there's never seems to be enough time to get through everything that I'd love to just jump into it. If people are looking for any other past information and want to listen to the other shows, they can go to one of two places. They can go to autism1.com and listen to our past shows on the same subject, or they can go to nourishinghope.com, and either way, get access to those. Also, there are going to be some slides that we're going to be using for today that if people are interested in following along on those, they can go to nourishinghope.com, and I believe, can they go to the Metametrics website for that?
They can.
Okay. Great, great. So we are currently working on our August show for Autism One Radio, Nourishing Hope. I'm Julie Matthews, a certified nutrition consultant, and you can find out more about me at nourishinghope.com. Well, let's just jump right in here, and we wanted to start with Nathan. Nathan is a five-year-old boy, and he is on the autistic spectrum, and what can you tell us about what he's presenting that can help us understand a little bit more about what's going on for him?
Okay. So Nathan is a similar to Leanne, and we discussed Leanne last time, and you can see both of these on the slides. He's a five-year-old diagnosed with ASD, and he has some of the some of the typical characteristics. Unfortunately, I don't have a great history on him, but he did have some decline in social reciprocity, some self-stim behavior, and I believe the onset was post-vaccine, but not a whole lot on him clinically. He's not one of my patients. But we can certainly see on his laboratory that he's similar to Leanne in a number of ways, and he has that elevated quinolinic acid. And a brief review on that is that quinolinic acid is a neuroactive compound that's released in response to some infectious process. So Th1 elevation, macrophage stimulation, macrophages crank out the interferon gamma and then stimulate the production of quinolinic acid from that interferon gamma stimulation. Quinolinic acid is a strong upregulator of glutamatergic activity, so it's agonistic to glutamatergic receptors, so our excitatory neurons, the glutamatergic neurons, which also interface with the dopaminergic neurons, specifically the ones that Dr. Richard Deeds has spoken about so eloquently in their involvement in autism and, you know, learning and memory and perception of pain and so forth. The glutamatergic and dopaminergic work closely together. So he's got elevated quinolinic acid, and we want to just think with him that there's some kind of an infectious process going on, so that needs to be back there in our differential. And it also, you know, how we're going to work with him, and we also want, so we want to think about bringing quinolinic acid down, specifically things that we can do to actually impact its binding to the NMDA glutamatergic receptor site, and then also treating the infectious process. And we suspect here in the lab that that infectious process could be of gut origin. Mm-hmm. It could be elsewhere. It could be that, you know, it's a natural response to a vaccine, but we suspect again here in the lab that these children have some sort of a deficit that causes them to not respond appropriately. So when quinolinic acid elevates, it may be part of the precipitating event that starts the regressive episode. So there just seems to be something there. And of course, more and more research is coming out around different issues in the CNS, and glutamatergic activity has been implicated in some ways. So there it is. It's up. Do you want me to throw out a few interventions?
Sure.
Okay, so things that we know that can inhibit quinolinic activity at glutamatergic sites include theanine, so the amino acid compound from green tea, theanine. Magnesium can help inhibit, as can taurine. So things that modulate calcium channel activity and have kind of a calming effect, taurine, magnesium, theanine, B12 may also be effective as well. And quinolinic elevation or activation long-term is definitely neurotoxic. I mean, this research has been done looking in neurodegenerative conditions like Alzheimer's disease and Huntington and, you know, other neurodegenerative conditions. So we don't want this guy to be up for a while. We want to see it bump down. And if we look just below that at 8-hydroxy-2-deoxyguanosine, that's an oxidative stress marker. So that's evidence of increased DNA repair. So increased damage causing increased repair, you know, a good solid marker for oxidative stress. And we see in Nathan that that's quite elevated. So those are two really important markers that we want to tune into and deal with. Now, why are they elevated? What's going on? With quinolinic acid, we've talked about the infectious process occurring there and also assisting his body in mounting a normal response. So first step is just glancing at those elements. The essential elements in Nathan are very, very low. And we so commonly see that in children on the spectrum. His magnesium is rock bottom, below our reference range. Manganese, also very low. Chromium and copper, just barely normal. Selenium and zinc, also really quite low. So the things that help us both fight oxidative stress and mount and stop an immune response are really rock bottom. Just looking at his trace elements. So trace elements alone are just so important and going to make a difference in this child. And then we look over at the, you know, our B vitamin markers, and we can see that he's got a really strong need for B6, for biotin, and then a multi-B including thiamine and niacin and riboflavin. His urinary methylmalonate, a real sensitive and specific marker for B12 deficiency. We can see that that's demonstrating, remarkable or pronounced elevation. You can see up above our 95th reference interval. So really strong need for B12.
Hmm. What would be the cause of the low levels of the minerals? Is that a gut issue? Do we have any idea? Is this commonly seen?
It is commonly seen in children on the spectrum, and we know that most kids on the spectrum are presenting with some kind of a problem going on in the gut. So it's really up to the clinician to do the sleuthing. That's a great question. So when you see sort of that that pattern where everything's shifted to the left, everything is presenting low, not just a single mineral, but all of them. Mm-hmm. So you want to be thinking about gut. Something's going on, like a hypochlorhydria, you know, compromised absorption, compromised nutrient breakdown. And of course, those things are always hand-in-hand when you have some sort of a gut pathology, some kind of an irritable bowel or colitis. Frequently, pancreatic insufficiency follows, and obviously, hypochlorhydria is going to be a player in there eventually. So everything really gets compromise.
Mm-hmm. Now, hypochlorhydria being low hydrochloric acid, correct?
That's right.
And do we know what creates that? Because I see so many kids with reflux and other various things when they're young. Any idea of what it is that's creating, and if that's somehow related, or if those are two totally separate things, the hypochlorhydria and the reflux and all of that?
No, I think they are related, but I think that it's multifactorial and it's different in different individuals. But big, big factors include reactions to food, you know, compromising that lower esophageal sphincter and causing a reflux, you know, allergic reactions to foods or food sensitivities. Any kind of, you know, our gut, our whole alimentary canal uses a ton of energy, the bulk of our ATP. You know, really is used in that long stretch of tissue. So if there's compromise in the ability to generate, you know, just generate energy, there's going to be one of the first places we're going to see that show up is in the gut and in our ability to really adequately make HCl. So any lesions in energy production, and we see that commonly in these kids. You know, just his low zinc status, you know, some of these essential minerals are key in being able to make HCl. And then, and there's just such a sophisticated chain of reflex actions that cause a normal, you know, just the normal, the symphony of that is digestion to occur.
Right.
From the cephalic phase and the ability to move into your parasympathetic, you know, just relax so that you can generate adequate amylase in your saliva, and then if that process occurs in this relaxed state, you know, the stomach starts to sequester hydrogens to make HCl. So you really need to have this normal process. And as soon as that occurs, you know, the sphincters tighten or, you know, prepare to allow food in, and then they tighten up to allow the process of digestion, which then begins the pancreas and generating adequate bicarb as well as pancreatic enzymes for that whole next phase.
Mm.
It's a really powerful and elegant symphony, and it's notoriously compromised in children on the spectrum.
Sure. And what about the in the opposite side here? The minerals are low, but the B vitamin markers are showing high. What does that mean? Does that mean we have an excess or a deficiency?
Yeah, that's great. Okay, so that's the difference between a direct assessment versus a functional assessment. So for the minerals, we're directly assessing them. We're taking red blood cells. We're getting rid of all that protein from the red blood cell, and we're just counting the minerals present using a machine called a ICP-MS, inductively coupled plasma mass spec. So that actually quantifies the amount of each mineral present. But then when we look in the urinary, the B vitamin markers are urinary organic acids. So they're compounds that are moving through their metabolic process, and they're known to elevate when the enzyme downstream from that compound is compromised. So that enzyme doesn't allow that compound to become the next derivation.
Mm.
So that enzyme is somehow not functioning. And we know a lot of the research that we use to, you know, or what, you know, where these compounds were originally measured in comes from inborn errors in metabolism, where there's a real problem, you know, a genetic problem with the enzyme. But we've also learned subsequently that nutritional deficiencies can compromise enzyme function by limiting the cofactors involved in normal enzyme function. So in folks that don't have evidence of a genetic issue, and sometimes we uncover genetic issues in these tests, but in folks that don't, we want to really push that enzyme to function by supplying the cofactors. And so we can, you know, we know that methylmalonate requires B12 to move through its pathway and become succinyl-CoA. And then, for instance, the xanthorinate, which is a tryptophan metabolite, that is very sensitive indicator when that elevates of B6. So xanthorinate requires B6. To move through it to its next, to the next step. Does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely. Boy, there were so many questions I had here. So in terms of, well, I lost my train of thought because I had so many questions, but that's okay. So we've got these levels that are showing that, B6, definitely there's a B12 deficiency, it sounds like, from that methylmalonate.
Yes, that's right.
And then the other markers, which one is the B6 and the biotin marker for people that might be looking at their own test results?
Number 18, xanthorinate, which is X-A-N. TH, you'll see it there, xanthorinate. That is a sensitive marker for B6.
Hmm.
Just below that, number 19, beta-hydroxyisovalerate. That is a marker for B12. I'm sorry, for biotin, excuse me.
So when these levels are high, as they are with Nathan, then we are having actually deficiencies of B6 and the biotin.
That's right. So they're functional. It's functional evidence for deficiency. We're not directly measuring
it.
We're looking at its function in the body. So an elevation demonstrates a functional insufficiency of the nutrients that allow that metabolic pathway to take place. We see a block in that metabolic pathway and therefore an accumulation of that particular intermediate.
Got it. Okay, great. And what other types of things might a parent be looking at their, if they're looking at their test results and they're having some similar markers? I see there's some other markers here for Nathan that seem to be pretty relevant to his situation.
Yeah, okay. Are you looking at, you're looking at the methionine?
Yes.
Okay, so we know, you know, any parent or clinician working with children on the spectrum who stepped into looking at, you know, some of the complementary and alternative, you know, the biomedical treatments, we know that methylation and sulfuration play are often compromised in children on the spectrum, and we see evidence for that in the laboratory all the time, and Nathan is no exception. So, of course, homocysteine is required to both make methionine when it recycles back to the amino acid methionine using B12 and folic acid or betaine, and that's why those are such common treatments with children on the spectrum. Homocysteine also provides that sulfur in the form of cysteine to make the all-important glutathione to detox. So again, remember, his quinolinic acid is high, and if you look here on these, I should actually let parents know, his methionine is very low, and his homocysteine is low, and his sulfate, marker of sulfur activity or sulfation or sulfuration, all those sulfur-containing metabolic pathways, is very low.
Mm.
So we can say from this, those three low markers, that methylation and sulfuration are compromised in this child, and he has very likely has inadequate glutathione to fight oxidative stress, and we see that evidence in that elevated 8-hydroxy-2-deoxyguanosine.
Mm.
So his oxidative stress marker is cranking, and it's likely because of the low glutathione and also the low minerals and vitamins, the cofactors involved in making glutathione. And, you know, so we can really see that the story fits together pretty tightly.
Mm-hmm. So in terms of the sulfate level, is this a urine level or?
Mm-hmm. Yep, it's urine. Urine sulfate is a nice marker for total body sulfur. There's good evidence that you can extrapolate that a low urinary sulfate generally means low sulfur in availability, so low status of amino acids that contain sulfur, such as glutathione, taurine, methionine.
So how do you know if, say, sulfate in the urine was high, that it might be dumping all of their sulfate? How do we know if the low urinary sulfate is that their body is low or, you know, so I could see that both could happen. If you had the low urinary sulfate, you could consider it that the body might have a low level. But if the level is really high and the body's dumping sulfate, couldn't that also indicate that the body might be low? How would someone...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's actually a really, really good point. And that's why it's nice to have a number of markers that kind of move through the pathway so you can piece together the whole biochemical or as much of the biochemical story as possible. So get as many markers as possible looking at sulfuration and methylation to really see what's going on at different locations. Because you're right, sulfate, inorganic sulfate, is a byproduct of sulfation.
Mm.
So if this child is detoxing via sulfation for whatever reason and spilling tons of sulfate, yeah, absolutely, that could cause a problem of running out of sulfur that way. And if we look at Leanne, she had high sulfate. She did have high urinary sulfate. So that's a great question, and yet she did demonstrate oxidative stress and evidence of a need for glutathione and other markers. So really, really good question. And the other possibility for low urinary sulfate could be a need for the element molybdenum.
Hmm. Right.
Molybdenum is required for the conversion of sulfite to sulfate, and that's compromised in kids sometimes.
Sure.
So you could potentially see a low sulfate. It's actually nice and to have a sulfite-sulfate ratio. It would be real cool if we had that here at the lab, and what you would expect to see in a molybdenum deficiency would be a high sulfite and a low sulfate, demonstrating that movement from sulfite to sulfate is compromised, and then you could point the finger more closely at the enzyme sulfite oxidase and molybdenum. Yeah.
So
you're right. There are multiple ways that you can interpret, and you do want to piece together that story.
Sure, and I'm sure this is where their clinician comes in as the most important tool here to help to explain how all this goes together. Any other markers that Nathan wasn't presenting that would be important for the methylation sulfation? So if someone else were looking at theirs, is there anything else, or are these the primary ones you might be looking at?
Well, the amino acids, I didn't show the amino acids in him, but a lot of clinicians will measure 20 or 40 amino acids in the plasma. And that's a great snapshot to see, are each of the aminos present, needed to make glutathione, present in this child's plasma? Does he have the ingredients to make glutathione as well as the cofactors? We know he's compromised in the cofactors, and we know he's compromised in sulfur and methionine, but let's look at the other ingredients. So we don't have that information, and that's really important. What else? Oh, and then the 40 aminos. Clinicians frequently will just get a whole bunch of derivative aminos, and those are really handy for having further functional evidence for how well methylation is going on in the body and some other important markers as well. And if you look at the B vitamins there, if you look at methylmalonate, just below that is a marker called formaminoglutamate, and that elevates in folic acid deficiency.
Okay.
So we see it almost looks high normal in Nathan, but really technically it's normal. But we frequently see that elevated in children on the spectrum. Okay.
And how do you know with the, in this case, he has low methionine and homocysteine and sulfate, and you had mentioned that homocysteine can recycle up to methionine or down to glutathione. Is there a way to get a picture of what is happening for an individual and whether that would even be helpful to know? So can you, if the homocysteine were not recycling back up to methionine, would you see the low methionine and homocysteine, would it be different if it was somehow just shuttling down to glutathione? How do the relationship between how much of the homocysteine gets recycled versus how much of it continues to go down the pathway to glutathione? And does that change the way that somebody might work with a child based on that information?
That's another great, great, great question. You know, you're seeing folks on a continuum, and we do catch everybody at different steps. So that's another real shout-out for doing functional testing. So you really get the individualized snapshot of where your patient or where your child is. So the methylation pathway is very, very sensitive to oxidative stress. It's supposed to be. It's supposed to grind to a halt, maybe not quite grind to a halt, but it's supposed to significantly slow down in an oxidative milieu so that homocysteine is able to shuttle down to glutathione, taurine, and sulfate, you know, as it needs to, primarily glutathione. I mean, that's just a cool way that our body normally functions. And we know he's got a lot of oxidative stress, and he probably has for a while. So methylation has been likely compromised in him for a while. And he's probably, you know, he may have been able to shuttle homocysteine, but he likely did because he has regressive autism. So he had a period of normal development. He had a period of various levels of oxidative assault like we all do, and he was able to meet demand. But then either there was a, you know, accumulation of stressors or one, you know, the precipitating stressor that caused him to move into the regressive picture. And maybe that was when the homocysteine was low enough where, you know, if it was a vaccine, that initiation of oxidative stress from that vaccine or the detoxification necessary or the inadequate, you know, or the increased immune response from the vaccine, any number of things could have caused, you know, like Mrs. O'Leary's cow, she kicked over the lantern and started Chicago on fire. You know, that was his bucket became full at that one event, and he could not tolerate the oxidative burden at that point, and, you know, the regressive autism event initiated. So let me see if I can summarize that. Sorry if I'm
being
way too esoteric with my allegories here.
I just went to Chicago with Autism 1, and I just got to see the tour, so I'm on board with the fire anyway.
Yeah, so it's You know, it's the event that, you know, that started the whole issue. So the point is that we're catching children in a number of different places along the continuum of normal and abnormal methylation and sulfuration. And he looks like, you know, with his high oxidative stress and his really low methionine, homocysteine, and sulfate, that he's probably been in and moving towards this for a while. Sometimes we see people with no evidence of, you know, a normal 8-OHDG, no evidence of oxidative stress, but with evidence of increased glutathione use, you know, via, you know, there are different functional markers that we could talk about at another time, so we can see that they've been able to meet demand. Their body's been able to make adequate glutathione. Mm. But it's when it's protracted or when there's some sort of a lesion. You know, it could be cofactor deficiencies, as we see in him. We also know from Jill James's work that there's different polymorphisms associated with methylation and sulfation in these children. So any number of things can cause compromise in these pathways.
Got it. When you're talking about polymorphisms, talk a little bit about what we know about that. What do we know about methylation? Is methylation issues, are they genetic? Are they due to some deficiency that creates just a sort of a break in the pathway, but it's not, quote, genetic? What do we know about that piece of it?
I think yes and yes, both.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. Toxicants can interrupt enzyme activity. Metal toxicants are notorious for really compromising enzyme function and causing, you know, toxic events as a result of abnormal metabolism. Mm. So toxicants, they're notorious for messing things up, both metallo and organotoxins. Polymorphisms, sure, yes, genetic polymorphisms, so mild genetic polymorphisms. So under low stress, the enzyme can function just fine. Under cofactor repletion, the enzyme can function just fine. But turn the stress up, and turn down the availability of those all-important nutrients, and then the enzyme's compromised, and then we see, you know, the clinical problems associated with that. So there are a handful of things that can cause the outcome.
Hmm.
But, you know, as Jill James showed, children on the spectrum do seem to have polymorphisms associated with methylation.
Okay, and why don't you talk a little bit about the other page here? You kind of just gave you had given sort of a summary of the considerations for Nathan. Maybe you can kind of summarize that a little bit for people that are...
Yeah, so we want to figure out why that quinolinic acid's elevated, and we have a bunch of information now that, you know, his nutrient levels are compromised. He clearly needs some glutathione to support the oxidative stress with that quinolinate is likely a player in. So we really want to get to normalizing that with the nutrient abnormalities we see. We need to also do some more sleuthing in this child and figure out what infectious process is going on. A stool specimen or, you know, some assessment of dysbiosis is really important for him, including what's going on with his foods, what foods is he reacting to, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And does he have evidence of a systemic infection?
Right.
Just looking at that, are we seeing Lyme disease, et cetera? You know, the usual workup, CMV or Epstein-Barr, and it gets kind of challenging. But I would certainly, clinically, you know, what I would do myself as a clinician is really start with the gut. So do that, and then, as I said, modulate NMDA activity or the agonism of that quinolinate with threonine. Actually, it's theanine. Wait, is it threonine or theanine? It's theanine. I'm sorry. Threonine is an essential amino acid. I'm really sorry that I just turned that around. So it's theanine,
okay.
Green tea, the amino acid from green tea, theanine. Get rid of that typo, that R.
Mm-hmm.
Magnesium and taurine. And he's likely deficient. We know he's deficient in magnesium, and he's likely deficient in taurine. B vitamins and so forth. Sulfur, amino acids, antioxidants. So there's lots of work to do for Nathan right away, and he does obviously demonstrate a strong need for B12. You know, and as Jill James showed in some of her work, you know, giving the B12, betaine, and the folinic acid did seem to not only open up and normalize methylation, but it also opened up to normalized sulfuration and the amount of reduced glutathione present or the amount of glutathione, active glutathione, what can go on and quench free radical activity, increased significantly when B12 folinic acid and betaine were given. So lots of work to do for Nathan, and I suspect, since there's such clear-cut areas for improvement, that we will see some clinical improvement as well.
That's great. You know, I was really just thinking that maybe we would just do Nathan for today, but I just wanted to mention one thing about Joe, who's the next one on our list, because you had mentioned something really interesting, which is that he had some regression after DMPS, and I know that these types of things can be pretty common, and all sorts of different types of regressions, and can you just maybe take 2 minutes to just kind of talk about what you see as possibly being a factor for that, so that when people see regressions, they can see that maybe there's something on their test that might indicate what might be going on and how they might want to proceed.
Yeah, that's such a great question and really important. So, you know, a lot of parents will have, a functional assessment. They'll look at nutritional deficiencies and so forth, and they'll also do a workup for toxic metal burden, and you may have both come back positive, and so you may be eager to jump into doing some chelation treatment. And that was the case with Joe. They initiated DMPS treatment. Of course, I mean, it's logical. He had a metal burden. You want to treat for it. Now, he had a pretty pronounced regression after that DMPS. And when we look at the labs, we can see that at the time of initiating DMPS, he was still quite deficient in homocysteine, in total body sulfur. His essential elements were really low. His quinolinic acid was normal, his oxidative stress was normal, but he clearly had some nutrients that needed supplementing. Hmm. And I would argue that he didn't have all his ingredients to be able to respond to something that can be, you know, fairly aggressive, and that is DMPS chelation.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, clinically, I would want to work on getting their foundation in place, having a firm foundation so that when you initiate more aggressive treatments, that they have a better chance of positively responding.
Mm.
Okay, and he did. He was able to, you know, he came out of the regression, and he's doing well. But I would absolutely argue that putting that firm foundation in place would have been an appropriate starting place.
Right. I think that that's just a really, I think, key point to end things on, is that when you look at these test results, I know even for myself, for different tests I've had in the past, it's always a little upsetting to see some of these results, and you want to take action immediately and do something, but there is an appropriate time to sort of step back, slow down, build up the base, like you said, get some of the nutrients and minerals and things in order before going on and addressing some of these other challenges. So I think that that's just a good learning that we got from Joe, which is that we have to look at the whole picture, and we really have to see, you know, what's the most appropriate for an individual and how to proceed on a one-on-one basis, which is the nice thing about the lab tests, is that they help clinicians figure out how to approach individuals as individuals.
Yes, that's right.
Well, this has been great. You have been listening to Autism One Radio and my show, Nourishing Hope. I'm Julie Matthews, a certified nutrition consultant. You can find out about more about this show and about myself and my services at nourishinghope.com. And you can also find more about this radio program at Autism One Radio, or actually at autismone.com. And you can find out about Kara Fitzgerald, her practice, and also Metametrics. What's the best place for people to get information on you?
You can reach me at kfitzgerald@metametrics.com. That's my email address. The website is www.metametrics.com. And if you're interested in my clinic, that's Spirios Medical Center, and we're in Atlanta, Georgia. We're a large integrated clinic there, and we work with children on the spectrum quite frequently, and we're at www.spirios, that's spherios.com.
All right.
Oh, no, we're not. That's the wrong email address. I'm sorry. It's it's www.rethinkyourhealth.com.
Okay.
Rethink your health. Yes. I've been giving out the wrong one for quite some time.
All right, Carol, well, it has been a pleasure to speak with you again. Thank you so much for being on our show again, and I hope to talk to you further in the future.
Thanks.
All right, thanks. Bye.
Take care. All right. Bye-bye.